Okay, so basically I'm going to tell you about three papers that I've written over the last 3 years. It's a one a year type project. So these are papers with Sean Carroll and with two of our grad students, Lottie Ackerman and Chen Yao Tseng. And basically out of the three, one is a success and two are dismal failures. But I'm going to tell you about all three nonetheless. I'm proud of all my children. Okay, so what's the idea? What's this talk about? Where are we going? Is there any motivation or is this just a typical talk? So we have this beautiful idea of inflation. Probably almost everybody in this room believes there was an inflationary era. I believe there was an inflationary era. I found out recently that Paul Steinhardt no longer believes there was an inflationary era. But still, most of us believe there was an inflationary era. But to be honest, we don't have a lot of successes or observational facts or experimental facts, if you'd like, that lead us to that conclusion. And so because of that, and the fact that usually we think of this era as happening at a tremendously large mass scale, I think we should try to be as open-minded as we can and just ask ourselves what could things look like in a way that would impact the data. We have very precise data, in particular on the microwave background and large-scale distributions of objects like galaxies, and try to see how the data can constrain those possibilities. Of course, there's not much use in doing a project like this if your possibility you're trying to constrain is just some very ad hoc specific thing, like there was a small kink in the power spectrum at a particular wavelength. You wouldn't want to do that, something like that, without any without any motivation for such an effect. So the only way to try to do this that I think has any value is to try to make some fairly general assumptions and then try to that are beyond what we usually do, and then try to parameterize that in a model-independent way, and then you can at least constrain something by the data in a fairly model-independent way. So that's the idea. The things that we're going to try to constrain are rotational invariance and translational invariance. So it doesn't, right away you're thinking, uh-oh, we're getting a wacko talk. But it doesn't have to be a wacko talk, you know? It could be that if there is a violation of rotational invariance, it's not something fundamental. It's just some field, you know, this is in this era, gets a VEV that picks out a special direction. It doesn't have to be a dramatic change in the laws of nature as we know it. Although, of course, it could be. We're trying to do some model-independent parameterization of the effect. Of course, today we know that, at least to a very good approximation, that we have rotational invariance, conservation of angular momentum, translational invariance, conservation of linear momentum. And so what I want to imagine in this talk is that we had some new era, call it the inflationary era if you'd like. During that era, the density perturbations were generated. But also during that era, there was some small violation of translational or rotational invariance. And then after we exited that era and returned to a normal Robertson-Walker cosmology, more normal expansion, that these violations went away for some dynamical reason, perhaps. So that's the general scenario. So let's try to go from there, see if we can parameterize this possibility in some fairly general way, and then see what the predictions are and compare with the data. Okay, that's the idea of the talk. So why did I pick on translational and rotational invariants? They seem to be...
One example of this would just be excitations that dilute exponentially because of inflation, right?
That they would violate translational invariants, that's correct.
But that's already sort of part of the paradigm.
There are papers on that. Of course, usually, I should mention this. So the example that you gave, of course, we would expect that the chances of our horizon volume containing one of those objects is very small. And that brings up another, both of these ideas in some sense are against the spirit of inflation. Inflation is supposed to be something that just smooths everything out. You know, there's no remnants, you're just plain de Sitter space, And so these ideas are somewhat against that general philosophy. But as I said before, we don't know really what's going on there. And so if I can parameterize these possibilities in some model-independent way and get constraints on it, I think it's a worthwhile endeavor.
So in particular, you're looking for something that doesn't inflate away.
Well, I'll say a little bit more about models as I go on. So it ends up that rotational invariance is a lot easier than translational invariance. So the part that's a failure is the translational invariance part. So I'm going to tell you what I know there. And the problem really is the one you're bringing up, that I can do something that has the appearance of model independence, but I can't construct a model. So what's the point of doing a model-independent parametrization when you have no toy model that realizes that, you know, it doesn't seem right. Even by Milo standards, that sucks. But I have a success in here, so let's go on. So why did I pick rotational invariance and translational invariance? So let's think of what goes into the predictions that we compare with the data. So first of all, there's some power spectrum in what we call the... I got my magic pointer, what we call the primordial density perturbations. And we're going to Fourier transform that and take that variable to be delta of k. And it's thought to be some stochastic variable. And so we talk about correlations in this variable. And so we can start off with the two-point correlation. It's delta rho over rho, so the one-point vanishes. And if I write this two-point correlation, I can characterize it in the following way. As some what's called power spectrum, that's a function of the magnitude of the wave vector k, and then a delta function that sets k equal to minus q. Of course, this p of k is approximately 1 over k cubed. That's the scale invariance with some very small corrections. And then the density perturbations, they don't have to be Gaussian. So there could be higher correlations that enter into comparing with the data. And in various types of inflationary models, in the simplest models with a single field, normal kinetic term, you get that the correlations are highly Gaussian. But then you can have other models that are non-Gaussian. And of course, it's very interesting to search for that in the data. And people are looking at that and constraining that. So I'm not going to talk about the possible non-Gaussianities. The shape of the power spectrum is something important as well. It's very close to 1 over k cubed, the Harrison-Zeldovich spectrum. I don't want to talk about that. It's well discussed. You want to measure that shape, certainly. So what is it that's left for me to talk about? Well, why is this a function of the magnitude of k? That's rotational invariance. Why is this a Kronecker delta? That's translational invariance. So I'm not talking about rotational and translational invariance because, you know, I want to be different. I'm talking about them because that's all that goes into this thing. So if I want to go away from this picture, those are the things I have to talk about violating. Is that clear? Okay, so let's start off with rotational invariance. I'm much more comfortable with rotational invariance. I get nervous when I think about translational non-invariance. Don't want to be nervous at the start of my talk. Okay, so rotational invariance, what are we going to do? Well, it's going to be a model-independent parameterization, but I got to say a little something. So first of all, we're going to parameterize, we're going to say that the violation of translational and rotational invariance is due to a particular direction. There's a special direction picked out in this era where the density perturbations are generated primordially. And let's call that vector unit vector n. Maybe it's that away. I'll tell you which way it is in a moment. So how do I figure out how to parameterize my new power spectrum? Well, I can use what's called the Spurion method for doing group theory. This is pretty pathetic group theory. So what we're going to imagine is that this fixed vector rotates and then construct things that are rotational invariant. K also rotates. So what could we have here? We start off with the 1. This is the normal term. We could have something times, so k hat is just a unit vector along the direction of k. So we could have something linear, k hat dot n. But because this is symmetric in k and q, it would have to be n dot k hat plus q hat, and then that's zero for the, because of the delta function. So the first non-trivial term you get is k dot k hat dot n squared. And then you get plus dot, dot, dot. You know why I didn't write down the dot, dot, dot? Because it's negligible. It's negligible because the violation of rotational invariance is supposed to be small. So each insertion of this n should be a small effect, and we should just work to leading order. So what do we got so far characterizing this violation of rotational invariance in our formula? We got two parameters, which are, you know, the direction of the unit vector, some theta and phi angle, and a whole function. Too much. You know, we want to be very predictive. If you're going to be outlandish, you've got to be more predictive than this. We don't want a whole function. And so what we're going to do is suppose that the whole power spectrum is scale invariant, and so that this function g is just the constant g star. Of course, if it wasn't scale invariant, as modes went in the horizon, the effect of this term would either grow or shrink. And since we had a lot of eras for this to happen, it's probably either going to be ruled out or invisible unless it's scale invariant. That's the argument Harrison and Zeldovich made for the Harrison-Zeldovich spectrum.
Well, it could oscillate or something. I mean,
yeah. It could oscillate, it's true, but let's take it to be a constant. I'm going to build some models later on that, one of them, which is not the greatest model, gives a constant, but it really is an assumption at this point. It's going to fit the data beautifully. No. I would wait to go. Nobody even was surprised by my answer. Jeez, it's a tough crowd. Okay, so now we're down to four parameters. Three parameters. And one of the advantages of three parameters is you can go up and you can call your observational friends up. You don't, nobody speaks to anyone anymore. You send them an email, of course, and tell them, hey, you can go look for this. It's only a few parameters, and it should be not too hard. And of course, I don't have many friends, so I had to call someone in Norway. But still, the job got done, and we'll get to the comparison with the data in a moment. But first, I got to tell you how you make the prediction. And some of you who know me will be shocked that I could make this prediction, given that I know absolutely nothing about astrophysics. I wouldn't know a black hole from a hole in the ground. I figure if I fell into either, it would be bad. That's about all I know. But still, you know, basically, if you're a junior taking quantum mechanics, you can make this prediction. So let me go through the prediction for how it affects the microwave background anisotropy at the level that a theorist can then hand off to a competent physicist. Okay. So first of all, we have to characterize how this correlation affects the microwave background anisotropy. So usually what you do with the microwave background is some fluctuation in the temperature divided by the temperature in some direction in the sky. You look around, the temperatures are what they are. And then what you do is you integrate against YLM, spherical harmonics, to extract the multipole moment. So what we're going to be interested in are correlations of the multipole moments. Most people would put a YLM star here, but I don't know why we did this. Just some temporary insanity. It doesn't matter. So now we have to put all the astrophysics in. So delta T over T, well, one thing you have to know as a physicist is it's linearly responding to the density perturbations because they're small. And so I want to superimpose all the modes, k. So I have this integral d3k. There's some function called the transfer function that, oh, and then I have to have this dependence on the direction e. So, you know, it can depend on the cosine of the angle between e and k. And you can just pick any functions you want, but we'll use the Legendre polynomials to characterize that. Then this function theta L of k is a function of the magnitude of k because I'm assuming there is no violation of rotational invariance after. It all occurred during the special era. Then you get the minus I to the L because this is a real function and delta star of k is delta of minus k, and this with a minus k makes a minus 1 to the L. So if you don't want the thetas to be complex, you've got to put in the minus I to the L. Of course, I went through this because in our original version of the paper, we left out the minus I to the L. And I have more to say about that later. But that's why you get that factor. And all the astrophysics, the part you have to be a skilled astrophysicist for, the part that involves the acoustic peaks, the part that changes the primordial 1 over k cubed to something linear in k, that's in these functions theta L. Don't know them. They are what they are. We don't need them. We're just lowbrow theorists here. Wow. I know some of them. Okay, so what do? You look up in Jackson, there's this magic formula, let you write this as the sum of spherical harmonics of k hat, spherical harmonics of E, then the integral over the spherical harmonics of E is orthogonal against those YLMs, and so you get this final, very simple formula for what you need. And now what we want to calculate is this two-point correlation with L and M and L prime and M prime. So we have this integral, two integrals, you could say, 1 over k, 1 over q. And then this expectation becomes an expectation to the delta in cube. The delta function converts that to a single integral over k. You get the power spectrum, and then you get this part here. So the one piece, this is the usual piece, the piece that those beautiful plots were made from. What does the one piece do? Well, I mean, for that, you've got an integral over the angles here. Everything else depends on the magnitude of k. So you just get a delta LL prime, a delta MM prime, times some number that depends on L. And the reason it's got a delta LL prime, a delta MM prime, is because of rotational invariance. But now we got this extra term that we have to deal with. So what do? Well, you take each n hat dot k, and k, of course, you can write that as y1s of k. You know, y1, you know, you decompose this into n0, n plus, and n minus, and each multiply is a y1 something. You got it squared, so you got two y1s, two y's here. Just Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. You combine them to singlets, and that's what survives. And so you can explicitly write out what this is in terms of the components of n, which are characterized in terms of just the two angles and the strength g star. If I didn't have this a constant, then every multiple, would then have a different strength associated with the function of this k. So you'd have a lot less statistical power when you go to analyze against the data. So what do you need to be able to compare with the data? I have to leave you with something to enable you to participate in this field. I will leave you the name of my Norwegian friends. And then I will tell you that they want a sparse matrix. They don't want you to give them some jackass prediction for delta LL, some bad prediction for capital delta LM, L prime, M prime that connects every A with every other A and, you know, involves 7,000 parameters. You won't convince them to do anything. They want a sparse matrix, a few parameters. This matrix is sparse. Almost everything's zero, right? This just connects L to L plus 2. Mm-hmm. So they also want a model so that they think it's well-motivated what you're doing. They don't know how clever theorists are in particle physics at constructing a model. Okay, we're comparing with data. I want you to only look at the first line here. So there's different wavelengths of the I don't know a lot about the data, so I have to admit that right now. But there's different wavelengths you can look at. They're called bands. There's different multiple regions you look at. There's L. This was an analysis. Basically, they do a fit with this new parameterization against the full set of data and extract the parameters, the best fit parameters. So what do they get? They get G star is 0.29 plus or minus 0.031, a 9 sigma detection of G star. Congratulate me.
Very good.
Not bad. 9 sigma, we have measured a violation of rotational invariance in the microwave background anisotropy.
Can I complain now?
No, let me go through the rest of the data before you'll have your chance to complain. Now, I have to tell you, before when we wrote our original draft of the paper, unfortunately we have an erratum, because we left out the minus I to the L minus L prime, yet we still assumed the theta L's were real. Changed all the predictions, or some of the predictions, and they did that fit originally to the wrong formula, and they only had a 4 sigma verification of the effect then. But now it's 9 sigma. But let's just wait a bit. Let's look at the other data, the other bands. They look at some other bands. And, well, it's pretty significant in this band, but you know, it's differed by a factor of 2, a large difference in the value. And if we go to this band, it's again significant, but it's negative. Now that's a bad sign. That's a bad sign. But if that was all that was wrong with it, I would figure that eventually it would be okay. But here's the real kicker. They not only get the value of G star, they get the direction. And the direction in all the bands, so these are some galactic coordinates. That's some way that astronomers paint the sky. You know, we could probably look up on Google what L and B are. So let's look at those directions. They're consistent. Pretty good. That part's good between all of them. But we should ask ourselves, is there something special about that direction? And it ends up that the ecliptic poles are located along that direction. So if you're like me, after you're told that, you have to go on Google to look up what the ecliptic poles are. But I was able to do that, and Google told me. So you're probably aware of the fact that the Earth goes around the Sun. And that picks out a plane. I think that has something to do with rotational invariance, actually. Picks out a plane. And there's a direction perpendicular to that plane, and that's that direction, either that way or whatever. The two ways are the ecliptic poles located here and here.
How is that direction the ecliptic poles?
I don't think they're the same, but I don't know the answer. They got to do a big subtraction. Yeah, we could look that up. I don't think that there's. Will they try to point away from it? That's how they try to subtract the Sun. So they have this.
It's hard to subtract the Milky Way.
Yeah. Well, the Milky Way, they actually do a subtraction, so you could ask, you get an effect from that. But I don't think it's the same.
Well, clearly this plane is not important to this coordinate system because why not choose your favorite vector to lie at 99, 26?
Well, I don't know how this coordinate system was chosen, but maybe it's galactic coordinates. I don't know. Anyways, let's go on for a moment. I don't know. I don't think they're aligned the same way, but I'm not 100% sure of it. I don't know the angle by which they're different.
Obviously, it's just the way
the yes, they have to make a big subtraction, but also they point away from the Sun. They scan more because of that in the direction of the ecliptic poles. There are a few things there. But wait. I didn't get a chance to insert my joke, my one prepared joke. So you're getting it now a little out of order since I worked so hard on it.
Come on, Mark, you've already told 20 jokes.
But they weren't the prepared ones. So what do you see? What do you do when you see something like this? First of all, I should say that there's been a lot of evidence discussed in the literature about deviations from isotropy, special directions being picked out in the first 10 moments, they also, it ends up pointing along this direction. Of course, you get much more power by fitting up to L equals 400. So what do you do when you see something like this? You got two options. Option number one, call the Pope. You call the Pope, and you say the following if you get him to answer. Say, hey, remember that Galileo thing? You almost had it right. It's not that the Earth, you know, is the center of the, you know, that the sun revolves around it, but, you know, we're still special. The microwave background given by God is lined up with our plane. Option number one. Option number two is to say, well, this is some systematic effect. But it's kind of shocking in some ways. It's a, you know, this is not 10 to the minus 3. Pretty big number. And it ends up that if you ask how much power is in this, it's 5% of the power. So right away when people did this, they went back and looked at the extraction of the cosmological parameters from the microwave background data. And that does not change. It changes. The central values change a tiny bit within the errors. But still, it's kind of shocking that this stands here. It's obviously some systematic effect. And I don't think it's understood by the WMAP group. It's only really a year old. Why is it only a year old? Our paper, you probably didn't notice, the paper, the first paper of Sean Carroll and Lottie Ackerman on this was already almost a couple of years old. But unfortunately, we left out the minus I to the L minus L prime. And what happened when they fit to that was the detection was only 4 sigma, but it didn't point. It didn't point along the ecliptic poles. And so there Sean and I were, you know, come the end of the day, at least every third month, we'd head off to the Ath bar and celebrate the fact that when people paid attention and when the Planck satellite came, they were going to confirm this effect. It was going to be 9 sigma, and we were going to be famous for this crummy n hat dot k squared. But was not to be.
Sorry, I'm not, when you compare with the real delta theorem, you say you get the same significance for g?
No.
Or more?
When we, if you use the minus 1 to the L minus L, if you did what we originally did, it's less significant. It's only 4 sigma. And that's because it was mimicking part of this effect.
So doing it correctly, you get this significance, right?
You get this significance, correct.
In the direction?
And the direction is along the ecliptic poles. And so it's clearly a systematic effect.
The fact that the different bands give you different signs tell you something about the systematic effect?
It might, but I don't have anything to add about it. It's clearly some clue, but I don't have anything to add. I should say one more thing that, I mentioned this paper, but this paper by Hansen and Lewis, they actually found the error we had made. Called us up and asked us to check it, and also observed a similar type of effect, same type of significance, along the same direction. So this has been done by two groups analyzing the data.
So WMAP 7 came out recently, and they had one paper that was dedicated to showing that all these supposed anomalies were not there. Was this one of them? Or?
I don't think so. When was this paper?
Pretty recently, a week or two.
A week or two. Well, then I might have missed it, so I'm not 100% sure. So it's possible they have some explanation. This one is there in the data. It's possible they have some explanation of what to do with it.
When you do that, I mean, when you integrate over the whole sky, you have to make some model for what you do with it.
Yeah, you make a model for, you subtract parts of the galaxy, you subtract some point sources, which is more important at the larger Ls. They point the thing away from the sun, which is already in effect. Because of that, they scan more near the ecliptic poles. They have to make some correction because there's some issue with how the light comes in for the effect of the reshaping of the beam. So there's a lot of corrections that go into it. Yeah.
Is this sort of result dominated by the low L modes?
I don't think so.
So if you sort of threw out the sort of first 20 and you only sort of fit to the higher one, do you think you'd have just as much significance?
Well, it would be somewhat less, but I think it would still be significant. I don't think you'd get anywhere near 9 sigma from the first 8 or 10 modes. Well, actually, the sign from God. Oh, she's back on my side.
Is there another way of testing it by looking? I mean, this says, roughly speaking, you have 20 to 30% more that way.
Well, it's a little. Yeah, you can't really say how much is in total power because you could subtract the constant to, you know, this has got a shape to. But It's a big effect, yeah. So, well, you can see the paper's pretty recent that did these analyses. So I don't know what's known since those papers. I haven't heard anything specifically from the WMAP group. I'll look in this more recent paper, but you know, these were towards the end of last year. And we're only in February. So despite this discussion, I actually view this as a success. Almost. Because the goal was really to say, look, we've got this interesting data. We don't know anything, to be honest, about this era when the density perturbations were generated. Can we constrain possible violations of rotational invariance? And it's clear that we will eventually understand this and we will be able to get some reasonable constraint on that. So let's now go to the second issue. We have a model-independent prediction. Do we have a model? One model. Doesn't have to be a nice model. Doesn't have to be, you know, a model you could take home to your parents. You can keep it in the closet. It just has to be some model, because you want to make sure that this possibility doesn't violate any general type of theorem. You know, so you got to try to check that. And maybe you'll get a sense of how plausible it is when you do that as well. So model number one was constructed in our original paper, and it's really bad. And then model number two is a newer improvement. So what's model number one? So these are just toy models. They're not real complete dynamical models. They're just supposed to try to check out whether there's some basic principles that we're messing around with. So we're not going to do a real inflationary model. We're going to imagine that there's some cosmological constant during this era, so some density rho of lambda. We got Einstein's term, R. We're going to add some massless scalar, chi. So chi is supposed to be like the inflaton, if you'd like, but it's just a massless scalar. Basically, we're just going to calculate the two-point correlation of this massless scalar and see if it behaves like we wanted the density perturbations to behave. It's not a real inflation model. I could make it into one from this, actually, but let's not talk about that. How are we going to violate rotational invariance? Well, I'm going to put in a four-vector U sigma with the following Lagrangian. Kinetic term, kinetic term, kinetic term. I stuck in the VEV by hand with the Lagrange multiplier. Well, okay. You'd think, given this, you know, I'm sort of destined to succeed. I put everything in by hand. How could I possibly fail? How could this possibly not work? Just wait. So this field U picks out a particular direction during the inflationary era. We'll pick it along the z-axis. You can solve Einstein's equations. I did this part when I was back home visiting my 87-year-old mother on the kitchen table at home, just like when I was in high school. It was a blast from the past, although I probably wasn't solving Einstein's equations. She brought me a tea in the evening, just like that used to. It was kind of nice, actually. Anyways. You get in along the two directions, you still get inflation with different constants. And if you calculate the impact of this on the two-point correlation of chi, you can calculate it using perturbation theory, assuming these are not different, you get exactly the parameterization I talked about. The n dot k squared and g star ends up being almost exactly a constant. It depends logarithmically on k.
This theory is stable.
No, I'm getting there. Yeah, it's not supposed to be stable, right? There's sort of a theorem that says if you satisfy the normal energy conditions and you add some other matter plus a cosmological constant, it will go asymptotically to the De Sitter space. So we had to violate something. And we violated the weak energy condition. And then when you check to see whether the model's stable, it ends up it's not stable. It's not stable in the weirdest of possible ways. This is just the usual linear stability analysis, where you decompose the modes, and it ends up it's stable at very small q, that's the mode. It's stable at very long q. It's unstable when the q's cross the horizon in some band. Of course, I did a stability analysis. And not wanting to do any hard work, I looked at low Q, I looked at large Q, and I figured, well, isn't it surprising that this theory that violates the weak energy condition is stable? Yeah, this has been a bad episode. Just don't violate rotational or translational. But it's not stable.
But usually the modes are produced when they cross the horizon, but this is worse than that.
It's unstable. You'll get exponential growth away from this background in this era. And it's not just one point at some band. It's just it's bad. Okay, so it's clear that this is, you know, even with my low standards, this is not okay. So recently there's been some more work along these lines, quite recently, and there now exists a model that's stable. It's a pretty ugly model, but at least there's a model. So let me take a moment or two and explain that to you. So this model has an awesome name. It goes by the name hairy inflation. That's the good news. Now the model in detail. We got Einstein terms R. Now we got a real inflaton with the potential, and now we got some function of the inflaton field, this is just convention squared, times a U1, a gauged U1, F mu nu, F mu nu's. So you can guess now that this is going to get around the instability, because usually the instability has to do with in a couple of four vector, you don't have the gauge invariance, and that's what's going on in this other case as well. So at least in the region that's stable for low Q and high Q. So and this also gets around this theorem, because now it's not just the inflaton plus something else, there's coupling between them. And so what you end up doing to make this model work is this field, this function f of phi is picked in a way that this term is pumped. And so if you look at what, if you solve the classical equations for f, it wants to pick out a B field during the inflationary era. And you have to, so you could choose an f in a particular way that it gives you this constant roughly constant G, and when you solve the equations, gives you this background field during the inflationary era.
Wait, this isn't diluting because F grows in some way?
That's right, because F evolves in some way as the inflaton evolves. So it's tuned to the inflaton potential. That's why I said this is not a nice model in any sense. It's cooked up to do what you want to do, but people have analyzed the density perturbations in this model as two groups, and it can give you the effect that you want. So I'm not advocating this as a nice model, but at least I believe it's enough to establish an existence, in quotes, example that shows that there won't be any type of impossibility, very general impossibility.
You say so the inflaton is pumping the magnetic field?
Right.
And what kind of magnetic field are you getting?
Well, it's a B field along a particular direction.
People have tried to get primordial magnetic fields.
Right. So I don't. Right. So you have to do this. So you have to like e to the kappa phi squared is the example, and you have to adjust kappa in a range tuned to how the phi falls down the potential V. It's not it's not something that you would view as a plausible argument. But I'm not trying to use it in that way. It's just supposed to be something that says, okay, there's something in there that we're not, it's not awful, it exists as a possibility.
I thought it's very hard to write down a universe system with a magnetic field, like this Melvin universe and so on. Does this model avoid that problem?
Well, I guess so. I wasn't aware of the problem, so nothing fancy is done there. They just solve the Einstein's equations and the field equations for the coupled problem and write down a solution. So
probably want a small field in a restricted region.
No, it has to be uniform.
Well, it has to be uniform over the inflating volume.
Right.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be in the whole universe. I don't know. It could have different patches. So they just solve locally the field equations. And okay. Translational invariance, part deux. How much time do I have? 20 minutes. The less time, the better. So this part, we didn't succeed. I'll tell you where we didn't succeed in case I don't get that far. We didn't succeed with the model part. Perhaps it's not surprising. This really is very much against the spirit of inflation. And so let me go on. You could have accidentally a point defect in our Hubble volume. It's true, but okay, so let's go on. So first of all, there's other ways to get this type of effect that might not be so surprising. Like if you had just enough inflation so that our horizon volume is bumping up against another bubble, or you had bubble collisions, then you might expect some visible effects, violations of translational invariance. But they're not going to be the type of thing I'm discussing where something is generated primordially and turns off. So it's not in the class of things that I'm discussing. So I don't want to leave you with the impression that it's not worth looking for violations of translational invariance. And people do talk about that. They are looking in the microwave background for some effects like that. But it's not going to be in the class of things that I'm going to discuss. I'm trying to mimic what was done for a rotational invariance, where it just exists in the inflationary era and then goes away. So one thing you might expect, so let's just discuss the case of a special point. We're going to violate translational invariance with a special point. If there's more than one, you could superimpose these if you'd like. But let's just say there's one special point in the volume that we observe, call the point Z star, and then we want to figure out the impact this specialness exists during the inflationary era and then goes away. If it was a defect, it somehow disappeared, unwound after, if you'd like. Okay, so first of all, when you're solving the field equations for the inflaton, if somehow this defect coupled in some way, it might act like a source, and you'd think it would induce, just in the classical evolution of the inflaton field, an effect that depends on the point Z star. And that would manifest itself as a one-point function. That'd be a one-point function delta, classical contribution if you'd like, that depends on where you are. But, you know, if you subtract out a constant, you won't be subtracting that out. I have nothing more to say. That's one possibility. But I don't want to discuss this possibility. I want to imagine for the moment that this is small, and see if I can do so. I don't even know what the limits are on this. They're probably something like this can't be more than one part in 10 to the 4, is my guess. But I don't think anyone's done an analysis just based on this. I mean, we do have this large, under density. Maybe Z star's in the center of that or something. But let me go on. So we're going to say for some reason this ends up being small. Maybe this doesn't couple to the inflaton directly. Or to the mechanism that the density perturbations are generated. And so this is small. And then we're going to go on to the two-point correlation like we did before. So it's convenient now to write it out in coordinate space. And what you do there is you use the same Spurian idea. You restore translational invariance by having this also translate. So this difference is translational invariance. And then it can just be some function of all these variables that, of course, is symmetric under interchange of x and y. You can't give that to your Norwegian friends because it's not a sparse matrix. Okay, so I have to do something to make it sparse. So I'm going to now proceed to do something to make it sparse. So first of all, we'll Fourier transform. So if we Fourier transform this in general, when we're violating translational invariance, you can get this, you can get this, and you can get a power spectrum, or it's not a power spectrum now, it's a function of k, q, and k dot q. We're imagining that we still have rotational invariance, but it's rotational invariance about the point z star. So we're trying to preserve as much symmetry as we can in this discussion. So we have the full rotational invariance, but it's now with z star at the origin, but we've broken the translational invariance. Well, what do we know? We know that this has to be a small effect because the standard analysis works. And so this thing has got to be approximately the delta function we want. So if we have p equals k plus q, it's got to be a very strongly peaked object in p. And so let's write the thing in terms of p and l, which is k minus q, change variables, and then say it's strongly peaked in p. Okay, about p equals 0. So I'm going to take this function, I'm going to write it as the exponential of something, and then I'm going to expand that in p and stop at quadratic order because it's strongly peaked about p equals 0. And then I'll take this part back down, which just depends on l, and I've got this. Well, now You can, of course, do the integral here over p. Because that's an integral like this. U to the I p dot z, where z is x plus y minus 2z star, and it ends up over 2. It has to do with whether you use p plus l over 2 or p plus l. Don't worry about that. So this is the integral we know as particle theorists, because it's the one you do for every Feynman diagram. And you just get an answer like this, where, you know, usually you complete the square, yada, yada, yada. You get the C inverse here with Z. You then expand. And so delta X and delta Y now has this form. And this is our small correction. And the C, this matrix, ends up being 1 over A this, and this times this. So now what are we down to? We're down to our special point, Z star. So that's three parameters and two functions, A and B. And presumably this overall function, this is the usual power spectrum that we measure. So it's approximately 1 over L cubed with a constant of proportionality. To get a little more sense of what's going on, I could pick a particular p. This is not a model. This is just sort of playing around with arithmetic or math. So I know that the delta function is a limit of this as d goes to infinity. So let me just pick a power spectrum that has some constants a, b, some f here, and then have this object here. And then this power spectrum has our parameter d. And as d gets big, it goes back over to the usual inflationary prediction, the delta function one. So now I can do the integrals exactly and look at it as a function of d. And this gives us a and b of l being constants independent of l proportional to d squared. And so if you go back up to this, you just end up with the z's, this z transpose, c inverse z, where these are now just a number over d squared, a number over d squared. And so what you end up with is two numbers and three numbers here, five numbers. And d is the parameter that sort of controls how big this effect is. So d is going to be, in terms of units today, not during inflation, some pretty big thing, something like our horizon volume. So this doesn't get to be too huge, our horizon length. OK. So that's the model. That's the parameterization. We've got it down to five parameters. I had to make more assumptions. I mean, I clearly, maybe you don't consider it more. I don't know. I assume that these things now have dimensions, just go like the d squared. And so you just pick out the overall power spectrum. So now we got to go and make predictions for the microwave background anisotropy. So first of all, let's go back into coordinate space. It ends up, if you look at things that violate rotational invariance and you try to compare with galaxy surveys, you get much weaker constraints than if you compare with the microwave background. Like I could have mentioned before that I could have taken that parameterization with rotational invariance and I could look at large surveys of galaxies and try to get a limit on G star from that. And it ends up that the limit you can get, well, of course, they won't have the same systematic as the microwave background. So, maybe there isn't the detection. But also, you just get a very poor constraint on G star. But apparently, if you violate translational invariance, it's a more powerful tool. And so here I've written out the thing in coordinate space. I put it in blue because I like it. I'm proud of it. So it's in blue. So it's just your usual term. A term like this times this, and then another power spectrum in a term like this. And there's these things, and perhaps they're both proportional to p0. But now we're on to the microwave background.
And in this case, if you had a distribution like, you would just sum over them?
You would sum over them with some weighting, the point z star, assuming they don't interfere with each other in any way. Each one's a small effect.
Right. There's just one point?
Just one point located at z star. one special point in our horizon. If there, so that already seems a little weird. If there were more, then you would super, and they, provided that they were each small effects, so they weren't interfering in some way, you would just superimpose this formula. You could integrate against G star if there's a against Z star with a weighting if there's a distribution, or a sum if there's just a few. Of course, then your predictive power goes down as well. Because you, if you want to fit against the microwave background and do some global fit, you know, if you add more parameters, the statistical significance of anything you extract is going to.
Normally they would just separate outside of your horizon.
Right. This is against the spirit of inflation in the sense that it's supposed to smooth everything out. But perhaps that's not even really what's going on. Let's just keep an open mind as we can.
So, I mean, in this, you would be somehow artificially keeping them inside the horizon? Is that
okay, so if everything's spread out, we could just be lucky. It's like somebody wins the lottery.
It's the one that's really close to the special.
Well, yeah, no, I understand. There's just one.
Yeah, so I agree. This is weaker than the... I respect all of these things you mentioned. It seems implausible. On the other hand, if I can do something model independent to parameterize it that can be compared with the data, I'm going to do that.
There is a way to do this which is analogous to what you did with the detail, which is to have particle production effects continue to produce particles as you go.
So people have talked about particles inflation, and then they each act as sources, and the dominant effect. Typically, well, it depends. If the field couples for the particles couples to the inflaton, then you get that classical source term. But it could not, I guess, and then maybe you could get, then maybe this analysis would be valid, but you'd have to superimpose over the sources. Yeah. But, again, I want to say, perhaps all these ideas are just wrong. That the ideas of how inflation works and... if you can look for it, you can parameterize it in a simple way, it's something I would advocate. Perhaps, provided you can construct one toy model to show that it's not just not allowed for some reason. So let me finish up and just show you how you do the microwave background with it. I really don't have much more to say. I had one kind of model for a line, which if there's time, maybe I'll say a little bit about.
So, but you're not going to present a toy model that you're happy with for this?
No, there just isn't one.
So that's just the...
So why isn't there one? Part of it is the effect that's mentioned that that inflation really does tend to spread defects out, right? It just does. So if you have some era, and even if you don't believe in inflation, these things are probably generated in some era where R grows faster than linear T, that is spreading things out. In fact, it's probably even exponential. Otherwise, why would you get a scale invariant spectrum? So that is a drawback. I don't have anything to say. Nonetheless, even with that drawback, I still think, there's some value to trying to parameterize this.
When you're trying to find a model, you're trying to find a model with a vanishing one-point function. Is that one of your constraints?
Well, it would be with a vanishing one-point function, right?
But if you didn't put that constraint,
if you don't put that constraint in, and you're willing to superimpose over a lot of Z stars, then these particle models already. Our examples. That's correct. Right. That's correct.
So why are you making that constraint?
Well, there really isn't much for me to say in that other case. That one-point function is the answer, and it's, you can look for things like this. Then it's just some shape, some classical shape that you have to look for. Yeah. Well, it's not a sparse matrix in ALM space.
I mean,
but
having, the inflaton coupled to some field.
No. And people do look for that. They look for effects like voids, which are in some sense a special point, the location of that void. They look for effects from bubble collisions, which are sort of, circles in the sky. So it's not that they don't look for violations of translational invariance. But in the spirit of what I was doing, this class of things that I was trying to construct here, I don't have a plausible model. So you could just say, okay, well, then I don't view this as a likely possibility. That's okay. I don't either. But now, it's one half of the things that went into the two-point function. All that went into it was rotational invariance and translational invariance. And so I wanted to try to change both halves in as model-independent a way as I could. So that was sort of the goal from the onset. That's the spirit of the talk. And I wish I could do better on this part, but It is what it is. Okay, so I want to go back. Yeah, so I want to Fourier transform this because it's correlations of delta K and delta Q that are related to the YLMs. And so then I have to integrate D3Q e to the I Q dot X, D3K e to the I K dot Y, not the original K. And then what you do is these factors of X and Y, you write them as derivatives on those exponential gradients with respect to K and Q. And so once you have it like that, you can get a formula like this, like we had before. Well, now there's no delta function, so I have both the integrals over K and Q. And if I look at the term that went like P1, for example, just one of the two terms, then because those factors were converted into gradients, you just get gradients like this in front of this. That's what you put in for this two-point correlation. And then you've got to go do the integrals. So let's just think about how you do those integrals for a moment. So basically, these gradients act on this. What you do is you integrate by parts to get them acting on these functions here, the YLMs, and the theta L of Q. And then you decompose your gradient into a point along the direction of K, and then the derivative with respect to the magnitude of K, so it doesn't affect the YLMs. And then there's something in the perpendicular direction that you can write in terms of a spherical hump, in terms of an angular momentum operator. Not the real angular momentum operator, not quantum mechanics, it's just the differential operator acting in K space. Well, now you're down to integrals like this, where this is just YLMs, it'll give you the usual delta functions, integrals that involve L. You can do those using what you learned about angular momentum and quantum mechanics. You can do all those integrals. You can make a very explicit prediction. The last one that we made for the rotation connected L to L plus 2, it ends up there's lots of terms here. They're able to connect L to L plus 2 and L plus 1, but no further. So the matrix is very sparse. It's characterized by more parameters if we take the constants to be the piece to be proportional to the Harrison-Zeldovich spectrum. But the real weakness isn't that. The real weakness is the lack of a model. Of course, you can do the same idea for a special line or a special plane. But again, it's really hard to get a plausible model. So I'm kind of out of time. The last section of this talk was, I got desperate at this point. I'm not going to go through it. I'm just going to tell you what we did. I got desperate. I wanted something. So in a moment of desperation, I computed the effect of a special line. Why did I pick a special line? Because the metric is basically to sitter space away from the line anyway, just with a deficit angle cut out. And you can do perturbation theory in the strength of that deficit angle. And you can calculate this new power spectrum. So we did all that. It's kind of a neat formula. There's the shift in the power spectrum. Of course, so it's got a piece that's translational invariant that violates rotational invariance, and then just some other piece. The reason this is desperation, it's scale invariant, and I knew it wouldn't work because there's nothing, the line is infinitely thin. There's nothing to characterize to the scale D. So you're just going to get left with something that's scale invariant with no scale D in it, nothing to expand, nothing to make the matrix sparse. But at least it was an example we could compute. So thanks for your patience. I think we look forward to the resolution of this systematic effect in the WMAP data. And in the future, I hope after that's resolved that we'll talk about the constraints, at least for the possibility of violating rotational invariance during the era in which the density perturbations were generated. Thank you. Yeah, but it's very weak, it ends up. I don't really understand this, actually. I don't know the number. I think there was an analysis, I believe, by Chris Harada. And I'm not even sure he published this part. I think there's other effects that you don't get in this. There's something called the hemisphere effect. which is more like an L equals 1 effect. It separates the two hemispheres, and they looked at that. And then when I asked him about this, he just told me that it's very weak. It's not worth even talking about. And I don't really understand why that would be the case. But that's what I was told. It was powerful constraint on possible models to explain this hemisphere effect. They almost all got ruled out. There is in the data claimed to be a hemisphere effect that's statistically significant, that one hemisphere is got a different amount of different distribution of ALMs, or there's some difference in the power. It's like a dipole picks out a. I don't remember the alignment of the hemisphere, but I believe it's not the galactic plane or the ecliptic poles. Yeah.
What about the Earth's hemisphere?
Well, you mean the Earth's axis or rotation? I don't think so, but I don't really know.
There is a dipole, of course, that they have to subtract.
Yeah, huge dipole.
Yeah,
that's a huge.
Maybe it's a pole through
Rome. Pole through Rome.
Yeah. But isn't it only 3 sigma and then it went away in the high L's?
Yeah, it's not nearly, it's not like this. It's not in the, well, it's only like 3.5 sigma. And I don't remember the distribution of L's. There were a lot of papers written on it, some of which claimed it was at, it also persisted at higher L's when they made some parameterizations.
I mean, it's a bit worrying that there's such a large systematic effect in the WMAP data. I mean, they're claiming that this is some very precise measurement.
Yeah, so in the power, it ends up it's only 5%. But still, that's supposed to be, and for some reason, it when you, if you go and re-extract the cosmological parameters, it has only a very small impact on that. I don't really understand why.
Are there different bands or just different wavelengths or something?
They're different wavelengths. So I think the one band, I think the one that tends to give you the most sensitivity to everything, the best data, is in what's called the W band. I don't know why. Maybe you have to do less subtraction at that wavelength or something. Well, you'd get some positive G star, clearly, because it's most significant.
Well, you have to wait.
And but it would still be along this direction. You know, I'll have to look at this recent paper to see if they talk about this, the WMAP paper. But you know, this was quite late, November last year.
Any more questions? Thanks for getting up.